Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon.
Sup? Welcome, everybody. Anybody here for the first time tonight? Welcome to all of you that are here for the first time. Welcome to anybody joining online for the first time. Welcome back, everyone else. Like to begin class, we'll have a period of meditation and then a topic and discussion. But I'd like to begin by asking you to speak to each other in service of building community. One of the core tenets of Buddhism is to associate, draw near, connect with other people who are on the path. It's called taking refuge in the Sangha. Sangha means gathering, community, people who are at least trying to be wise. I'm going to talk a lot tonight about suffering, because that's what we do in Buddhism. We talk about suffering and the causes of suffering and how to end suffering or try to end suffering. So the topic for your small groups, we'll start with this. And just as a reminder for people who are new and to people, we do these small groups for like 5 minutes and you have three people. So you get like 1 minute to, you know, kind of speed date on a topic. You just, you know, you concisely, you know, talk about the topic. And it's more of an excuse just to talk to some people in the room that you don't know, or to be put into these Zoom breakout rooms to you know, just connect with some people. The topic is suffering, and the question is, what is your favorite thing to suffer about? You know, I know you have like your top 10, your list of like things that you just, you know, love to suffer about and cling to and hate, but what's your, you know, and I say favorite, like most common, like what do you, you know, what's on heavy rotation in your resentment categories, you know, that you like to really suffer, you know, politics. Oh, I love to suffer about politics. Or maybe it's relationships, or maybe it's, you know, I don't know, some sort of self-centered self-hatred. I don't know what it is for you, but what is your favorite thing to suffer about? Talk to each other about that for just like a minute each, groups of like three. And really best if you talk to people you don't know so that you meet some people rather than just turning to your homies that you already are, you know, they're very familiar with your suffering and they're sick of it. So like share, try to connect with somebody that you don't know. And go ahead, groups of three or four at most, and at home I'll throw you in the breakouts. Here they come. We'll have a period of meditation, so find a posture upright, relaxed. Allowing your eyes to be gently closed. Softening any tension that your body's holding that you can soften. The brow, the eyes, the jaw. Feeling the breath as it comes in. And on your next exhale, softening your shoulders, your chest, your belly. Releasing. And reflecting for a moment on your aspiration. Your intention, your hope for what meditation will do, where it will bring you, what you will experience through this training of the heart and mind. Whether it's simply to decrease some of the suffering in your life, in subtle ways, or it's the the big, the ultimate aspiration of enlightenment, liberation. Whether it's for yourself or it's for the benefit of all beings, it's useful to remind ourselves of our aspirations, our intentions. As we sit down to meditate, whatever your intention is, bringing the volitional attitude of kindness. We can't hate our way to liberation. Bringing an attitude of friendliness, of kindness. The intention to accept ourselves, our mind, our heart, our bodies, just as they are. As we develop wisdom, as we develop more compassion, from this positive intention, establishing mindfulness, present time awareness, awareness of the body, all of the sense doors, the sounds, smells, tastes, images, even with the eyes closed, eye consciousness, and all of the thoughts and emotions that arise and pass through awareness. And then for a few minutes, choosing to direct our attention, to focus our awareness on the sensations of the breath, mindfulness of breathing, letting everything else fade into the background. Not trying to stop the mind from thinking, not trying to create a stillness or emptiness, just trying to ignore the mind for now. Let it be in the background. Give your full attention to your body, the posture, the sensations of sitting, and give special attention to the sensation that the breath creates as it comes and goes. If it feels like you're controlling the breath, that's okay, don't worry about it. But the intention is to not control the breath, not manipulate your experience, but to observe it. Let the body breathe however it wants, shallow or deep, long or short. Each time the attention wanders back into thinking, just acknowledge it, name it, thinking. It's a plan, it's a memory, a fantasy, a worry. And then disengage. Come back to the body, first foundation of mindfulness. Come back to the breath. Part of Mindfulness is a quality of interest and investigation, curiosity even. How does the breath feel? What's the duration? What's the texture, temperature? Being aware of the pause between the in-breath and the out-breath, the pause between the exhale and inhale, the beginning, middle, and end of each half-breath. And choose to continue the simple practice of mindfulness of the breath. Mindfulness of the body. And one teaching, the Buddha said, all of the Dharma, the nature of reality, the liberating truth, will be revealed right here in this body. Mindfulness invites us to turn towards what's happening moment to moment. You can expand to be more inclusive of not just the body, but the heart, the mind, the sense doors. Rather than ignoring the thoughts and emotions, bringing this same quality of non-judgmental, kind awareness, investigation, curiosity. What's my mind doing? What's the mood? What's the attitude? What's the content? Plans, worrying, hoping, memories, reminiscing, resenting. Craving, aversion. What kind of emotions are present? Joy, sorrow, loneliness, fear. Identifying what's happening in the mind. Not trying to control it, just bringing awareness, kind awareness to the mind states. Everything we experience physically, emotionally, mentally, at all of the sense doors, we experience as pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Bringing awareness to the feeling tone. Does the breath feel pleasant or unpleasant, neutral? Does the posture, contact with the chair, the cushion, feel pleasant, unpleasant, neutral? The thoughts that are arising and passing through the mind, through awareness, are they pleasant thoughts, unpleasant, or just neutral mind chatter? meditation like this reveals that all of the suffering is caused by craving, clinging, aversion, and self-centeredness. And the end of suffering, the antidote, the solution, is letting go of whatever we're clinging to, relinquish, soften, accept the impermanent nature of all things. To forgive rather than resent, to have compassion rather than hatred. The more we bring awareness, this quality of observing and investigating our human condition, the mind, the body, the more we wake up to the impersonal, not self, not personal nature of the mind. Its tendency to plan, to judge, to crave, to compare, not your fault. Just what the human condition is, just what the mind does. Useful to reflect on what the fuck just happened after you've meditated, to take a couple of minutes to recognize what happened, all of those mind states that came and went, and how many times you came back to your breath, to your body, to the present, what you observed, what you experienced. To recall, to recollect. A lot of what we learn isn't real time, but it's in recollecting what we're learning, what we're seeing. Do the instructions make sense? Do you have any questions about mindfulness, this type of mindfulness meditation, present time awareness of the breath and body, opening to all of the sense doors, the mind states, the emotions, and the feeling tone, what's perceived as pleasant or unpleasant or neutral? Does it make sense? Is it clear? Any questions about how to work with this kind of practice? Please.
When you feel the unpleasant, I know for me that like, that's really tough to get back into the meditation space. Do you have any tips to like, kind of get past the unpleasant thoughts?
For those at home, I'll repeat it. Question about when something unpleasant, and it sounds like mind states that are unpleasant, take the attention. Is you have the same about physical unpleasant, or is it mostly about the mind states?
Physical.
So when pain, unpleasantness becomes our experience, how to work with that and to kind of come back, I think you framed it as into the meditation space. This practice is asking us to let the pain be part of the meditation space and not, it's not, ultimately in these instructions, there's no such thing as a distraction. Pain is not distracting you from your meditation. Pain is your meditation. And so much of what Buddhism is teaching and wants us to learn is how to be with our pain. And so the mindfulness is actually turning towards, oh, this is very unpleasant. What's my relationship to it? Oh, now I see the aversion. I hate unpleasant. And that's my meditation. Oh, I need to learn tolerance. I need to learn mercy. I need to learn compassion towards my pain. Because so much of our life is unpleasant. And so much of this technique is learning to be uncomfortable. Really, like if there's one of the most important takeaways and benefits of sitting meditation is learning to be in pain. And if you're too comfortable and you're always having a pleasant time in meditation, you might not be doing it right. And if your intention in meditation is to create some sort of blissful, pleasant, calm space, it's not going to be all that beneficial in real life application when life is painful. So sitting still, I think that one of the main benefits of sitting still for longer periods of time is that hopefully you'll become uncomfortable. And I know some people are just like comfortable the whole time. You know, sit longer. If you know, if you can sit for 30 minutes and you're comfortable the whole time, sit for 45, sit for an hour, sit until your body is uncomfortable so that you have the opportunity to check out your relationship to pain and to develop compassion. So, you know, it's arbitrary to give it a percentage, but a half of the practice is compassion. And it's pain that gives us a opportunity to be with it. And so that idea that pain is distracting us from a good meditation, not from this kind, not this, there are meditations that want you to feel pleasant. That's not mindfulness. Mindfulness wants you to feel what's happening. And the reality is that when we start to check it out at the sense doors and start to really acknowledge pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and when you just look at what walking through the world, a good percentage of our experience is unpleasant. Unpleasant smells, unpleasant tastes, unpleasant sounds, unpleasant sensations, unpleasant emotions and thoughts. I mean, how, you know, if you had some sort of like, you know, if your Apple Watch could count your mind states and actually identify pleasant and unpleasant and neutral, I'd imagine that probably unpleasant is the majority for most people. Unpleasant thoughts, worries, cravings, of judgments, comparing, all of the afflictive emotions that are so prevalent, so unpleasant, so much of the human experience. Meditation gives us that opportunity to turn towards it, to learn to see it clearly, and then eventually respond more wisely. I hope that this will help you and everyone else that has this question of just reframing when pain is here. It's not a distraction. It's not pulling us out of the practice. It becomes the practice. We give our attention to it. Now, you know, if last week we were talking about, you know, if you can't sit still for 30 minutes, that's okay. If it's just too painful, if you're new to meditation, it's just too painful to sit still for a half hour, that's okay. Maybe you get 5 or 10 minutes and then you need to readjust. And then you'll work your way towards being able to be still for longer periods of time. I know for my, when I started meditating, I felt like sitting still was pretty agonizing. Both kind of anxious emotionally, and then physically. It was just fucking hurt to sit still, especially because the meditation classes that I attended back in the 1980s, there was no chairs. It was cushions. You know, you had to sit your ass on one of these fucking cushions, and it hurt. And these chairs used to be comfortable, but now they hurt after about 10 minutes because the cushions are kind of dead from them, on them. And then slowly over the years, we get better at being uncomfortable. We get better at tolerating it. And I don't know, I think of a meter that happens from aversion to less aversion, to less aversion. To, you know, or like kind of hatred of pain to less hatred, to less hatred. And that somewhere before compassion is the experience of being in pain, being with pain without hating it, being friendly, being warm, being caring towards pain. Compassion isn't getting rid of it. It's being with it in a wise way, in a friendly way, without aversion to it. But on the way to compassion, first, I feel like there's this sort of middle place, which is mercy. Have mercy on your pain. Mindfulness of it, turning towards it and being merciful. And something, the definition of mercy is something like not causing harm in a situation where you have the power to cause harm. It's not compassion. It's not even being friendly. It's just choosing not to hurt yourself. In this case, when you have the power to hurt yourself. And when it comes to pain, you start to see through mindfulness, we start to see, okay, there's my pain and my hatred of it makes it worse. My aversion to it, my fear of it creates suffering on top of the unpleasantness. And that mercy experience, which is, oh, I don't care about it yet. I'm not quite friendly to it. I'm just not meeting it with aversion. And that in itself is a merciful act, not making it worse. And then we get to the place where there's actually a sort of soothing energy and relationship. Compassion feels like it's a friendliness, not just a non-hatred, but an actual kindness, an actual warmth and care. For our own pain or for the pain of others. I hope that's useful. That's the way in this kind of Buddhism we frame working with pain in meditation. Anything else? Judy, last one maybe.
Can I give an example of that? Like, so your knee hurts.
Mm-hmm.
What and it pops up into your head.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that you're? Are you communicating? Are you talking to yourself?
Is there a verbal? Sometimes there might be. You know, like there's the compassion phrases. So, Judy's talking about I had a big knee surgery, and so it does. I have a little prop, a blanket under it, and helps a little bit. But it's like right now I can bring my attention to my knee and there's unpleasant sensations, and it's at like about a 4 or 5 right now, and in about 10 more minutes it'll be at about a 7 probably. So sometimes I will actually say, may I be at ease with this, like a loving kindness phrase, or I might even do a forgiveness phrase. May I, that sort of aspirational compassion, may I learn to care about this pain? Because I can see that instinctual aversion to it and that desire to alleviate it. And then at some point, I'll also, as you know, when I get to about a 7 or so, I'll probably straighten my leg and I'll be like, that's enough of that physical pain. You know, it's been an hour. I'll straighten my leg now and give myself some relief from that. Not avoiding it from the beginning, sitting with it till the edge. And then at some point before it gets to an 8 or a 9, and then I feel like I'm going to limp, then I'll straighten my leg. So sometimes there's a verbal aspirational, and sometimes there's no words at all. Compassion is not the phrase, it's the feeling. It's the feeling of kindness. It's the feeling of warmth. It's the feeling of friendliness. I feel like there's a big part in a relationship to pain, which is the acceptance. I'm like, I accept, I don't hate you, I accept you. And then friendliness, non-aversion, but it's an emotional state more than an attitude, more than attitude of mind and heart, more than it is words. But I found using the words over the many years of meditation helped me access the experience, the state. So I was thinking about talking about suffering tonight, and which is kind of always the Buddhist conversation on one level or another. It's said that there's an often quoted statement that went something like this from the Buddha. He said something like, I only teach suffering and the end of suffering. People would ask him all kinds of philosophical questions, and he would say, like, I'm not, that's not what I teach. I teach the truth of suffering, the reality that there is suffering. And then I teach a solution of how to end suffering. And that's it. I don't teach cosmology, although there are the 6 realms that I talked about a couple weeks ago. I don't teach philosophy. I don't teach astrology. I don't give relationship advice, just suffering. Although relationship advice is you're going to suffer. And there's a way to relate to our experience and the world where we minimize and end suffering. So one of my favorite things about Buddhism is the normalizing of the reality that suffering is normal. It's the way it is, that we live in a form, human body. We live on a planet where suffering is totally normal. It is the norm. It is the status quo. And the causes of suffering, I said it at in the meditation instructions, is the craving and clinging to pleasure and the aversion to pain, hatred of pain, resistance to pain. And it's that self-centeredness, I, me, mine, these kind of 3 causes. In the second noble truth, the Buddha just says it's craving. But it's craving for pleasure, it's craving for pain to go away, and it's craving for a permanent existence. I, me, mine, self-centeredness. I find it so liberating and helpful to understand this and then to not only apply it to the human, you know, our personal, your life, my mind, but to the world. The suffering in the world, the confusion in the world, to really see that craving is causing so many problems on this planet, not just in your life and your addictions and your cravings and your clinging and your, but globally, like all of the greed on the planet. aversion to pain, that fact that none of us are all that compassionate. Compassion is not a natural state for human beings. It's a developed wisdom. We're not born with compassion, or not that much. I don't know how many of you are parents or have been around babies, but babies don't have much compassion. They're little aversion machines. They hate being uncomfortable. That's not just because of dysfunctional parenting. It's survival instinct. Hate pain. You need hatred of pain to survive. You don't need compassion to survive. You need to hate pain. And that hatred of pain, and that becomes every form of the craving and the aversion, that becomes every form of ignorance on the planet. Every the self-center, the I, me, mine, selfishness of the human condition. That is sexism and racism and homophobia and classism and ageism and all of the isms. All coming from the human condition. Like, we can think of like oppression and ignorance as like these big external forces that are somehow like out there. Like, racism is out there. Sexism is like it's a system. But it's a system that comes from the human. It's normal. It comes from the craving and from aversion and from self-centeredness. Everything has been created, all of the problems on this planet. And on some level, I don't know, I still am stuck in a view that they're problems. Buddhism might say, just the way it is. It's the nature of things. Suffering, confusion, and ignorance is the nature of things. This is a planet that is run by greed, hatred, and delusion. It's the nature of things. It's the Dharma. It's the truth. It's reality. But as we look at our own minds in that initial question, what's your favorite thing to suffer about? You like to suffer about the way the world is? About all of the ignorance in the world? You like to suffer about, and maybe it's more personal, about your relationships, about your... I was reflecting on that in my own life, and I was recalling how I feel like in the early years of my meditation practice, I suffered a lot about craving. There was a lot of lust, in meditation, I'd have a lot of sexual fantasies. Like, maybe the first decade felt like a sort of sexual fantasy, in my meditation. And there was just all of this craving, and I just had a lot of, and this delusion that the right relationship, the right, would make me happy. That, you know, you have, some of you have that still. The delusion that there's this external refuge of a sexual, intimate, loving, relationship. And then there was a theme kind of in the second decade or so of my relationship, of my meditation, where my favorite thing to suffer, once I had children, I saw my mind's favorite thing to suffer about was money. Do I have enough money? Am I going to have enough money? Am I going to be a good provider? And then I'd sit in meditation and my mind would worry about finances. And now these days, the last, not whole decade, but like about 5 or 6 years now, when I sit in meditation, my mom, it's all about my mom. Freud was right. My mind wants to resent. There's all of these sort of wounds and abandonment feelings and betrayal feelings and resentments. And so I sit in meditation and my mind has this sort of like, knock, knock. You should have resentments towards those motherfuckers. And then just getting to sit with him being like, those are really unpleasant thoughts that are coming, whether it's the lust or the money or the resentments, those kind of top 10 top three, whatever it is, things that the mind wants to suffer about. And the mindfulness as an intervention and compassion as an intervention. And I think part of the reason I was thinking about this today is a conversation that I had with somebody this morning that was talking about how much they suffer about politics, about the state of the world, about the political situation, current political situation in this country. I think they were also talking about suffering about the environmental, you know, situation on the planet and all of the fires and the kind of local-ish fires that are happening. And just this sort of feeling of like, man, there's just so much suffering on this planet. And the suffering about the suffering, about the confusion, because there's some idea that it shouldn't be this way. I mean, I'll admit, I also often feel that way. It shouldn't be, you know, there shouldn't be racism, there shouldn't be sexism, there shouldn't be homophobia, there shouldn't be religious ignorance. You know, what's happening in Palestine shouldn't be happening. What's happening in the Congo shouldn't be happening. I often feel that way too. But I love that the Buddhism, that the Dharma reminds me, things are the way they are. This is a realm of hatred. This is a realm of greed. This is a realm of ignorance. And it all comes back to those seeds that are in us, the craving for pleasure, the aversion to pain, the self-centeredness, that human condition that created religion, and religion which is supposed to be the solution. The ancients created these philosophies to try to figure it out. And they created the gods, and they created the, you know, comforting philosophies about afterlife, or, you know, the reason it's like this is because we're sinners. So stupid. Such a stupid philosophy that the world, most of the world, is run by this monotheistic creator delusion that was created thousands of years ago. And, you know, humans murdering each other about religion, which was supposed to be a comforting sort of like, I don't know what the fuck's going on here. Must be God. But my God's better than your God. And I'm gonna fucking kill you because of it. What a weird planet we live on. So much of the problem from Buddhist perspective, from the way that I understand things, is looking outside of ourselves for the solution. Is that greed and that aversion and that thinking that if the world was different than it was, then I'd be happy. If you were different, I'd be happy. If you would just act right, I'd be happy. And Buddhism is one of the few, you know, I feel like most of the world religions are incredibly delusional, man-made philosophies of trying to deal with it, trying to deal with the suffering in the world, trying to deal with the suffering of the human condition. And, you know, 2,600 years ago, there was Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, and there was also Taoism, and a little bit later, Stoicism. There's been a few different kind of world philosophies and religious movements that were much more about emotional intelligence. That were much more about not looking to some sort of, you know, made up creator deity with the blame, or some sort of looking to the afterlife for salvation, but how to live. How do we live in this world with the pain? How do we live with our pain? How do we live with this repetitive craving for pleasure? How do we live with the impermanent nature of all things and the grief that is inevitable because nothing lasts, the truth of impermanence? And Buddhism offers us this very practical, applicable humanist psychology that is mostly about becoming emotionally wise, emotionally mature, in a radical transformation of developing, you know, that first question was such a great setup for it, because so much of it is about stop hating and resenting and develop compassion. Learn to be uncomfortable, learn to be in pain, learn to be with the pain of others, learn to be with our own pain and each other's pain, and be merciful and be compassionate. And not some external source, but from the inside out. How do I deal with my pain? How do I deal with the pain of being in this world of inequality and ignorance and corruption? And it's painful. Look at social media, turn on the news. It's all bad news. And selfies. This looking outside of ourselves. I don't know exactly why. I heard one teacher said, well, like maybe it's part of the survival instinct and the fact that our eyeballs point outwards, that we perceive the world out there. You know, we're always, we're not very introspective. Our design isn't very introspective. It's outer focused. I'm listening for what's out there. Is there threats? I'm looking for what's out there. Is there threats? But the Buddha's very practical solution is internal. Seek, one of the last things that he said as his sort of parting words and is seek no external refuge. Even becoming a Buddhist, even in sort of like thinking that like we can bow to the statues or we can wear the right beads or we can, this spiritual materialism that can happen in Buddhism and in all kind of spiritual religious traditions, of sort of looking to like, well, if I dress right and I, you know, bow right and I make the right offerings, you know, this really ludicrous, you know, I'm talking shit about religion tonight, but this really ludicrous thing of like Buddhism as a religion where people are worshiping statues makes even less sense than the make-believe God. Where the Buddha was like, no, I'm not God. This is you. You are the Buddha. You are the Buddha. It's like back in Oprah, you get a new car. And then, you know, humans fuck everything up, that externalizing and then turning Buddhism into a religion where we're worshiping statues, where almost none of the Buddhists on the planet actually meditate, are actually applying the teaching. The Buddha said, you want to get free? Meditate. Your path to freedom is mindfulness. You have to meditate to be mindful. In order to develop the compassion and the non-attachment, it's a radical internal transformation that necessitates a meditation practice. You can't read your way there. You can't bow your way there. You can't chant, you know, your way there. You have to do this mindful introspection in order to liberate yourself. It's the only path to liberate, the direct path to liberation. But it's so fucking radical. It's so counter to the norm. It's so counter to how we're wired, our survival instinct, our biological evolutionary imperative to crave pleasure and hate pain, to take everything personal, to believe you're, you know, we're all addicted to our minds. part of the intervention of the first foundation of mindfulness, where we start the meditation practice, where sit down, pay attention to your mind, I mean, to your breath, and ignore your mind. One of the most radical things that's happening there is breaking your identification, breaking our addiction to thinking and to believing what your mind has to say. And what a fucking dilemma. I don't know about for you, but for me, I came to meditation with a core distrust of humanity. I definitely came here with a sort of like, nobody's trustworthy. I'm not sure about this Buddhist shit. I'm pretty sure everybody's wrong about everything. But as I started meditating, and then I got this teaching of like, don't even believe your own mind. I was like, oh, fuck. But it made sense because I saw, oh, my mind got me strung out, got me locked up, got me all of this suffering that I've, because I've been believing my mind. But I didn't have any faith in other people, or maybe hardly any. I had enough faith to start meditating, to try it. Enough desperation to have the willingness to say, I'll try this. And then to turn towards the mind, you know, first learning that first liberating experience of like, I don't have to believe my own thoughts. I don't have to obey my own mind. And I'm not very good at it, but I can disengage from the content and what's happening in my mind and my emotions, and I can come back to my breath. I can take refuge. I feel like the first refuge that I experience, that most of us experience, is the refuge in the present time experience of paying attention to the breath and ignoring the mind. Now, it's the initial refuge, and it is, you get that concentration, that ignoring your mind is, you know, the definition of refuge is something like, you know, a place that's protected from suffering, safe from harm. Our minds are almost constantly harming us with the craving and the aversion and the self-centeredness. Ignoring the mind is a refuge, but it's not really a reliable refuge in the long run. And this is why the Buddha made a distinction between mindfulness practices and concentration practices, and said, concentration-based meditations will not be a reliable transformative tool. In the long, you know, they'll let you ignore the causes of suffering, which will feel like a refuge. Most people, I think most meditators stop there. Like most of the really popular meditation techniques are those that give us the temporary relief. That's why sound baths are so popular, breath work is so popular, you know, these sort of like TM is so popular. Chanting. I was talking to a friend the other day about the SGI Buddhists, the chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, those kind of simple concentration mantra kind of practices. They become very popular because they give you a relief. What just paying attention to the breath, like where we start, or what just doing a mantra doesn't do is develop compassion for pain. It doesn't. You can't chant your way. You can't concentrate your way to compassion. Also doesn't teach you how to let go. It also doesn't teach you how to break your addiction to I, me, mine, self-centeredness that is the cause of so much of our suffering. And it's where mindfulness is the practical, applicable, turning towards seeing clearly and developing compassion, non-attachment, non-identification, developing the discernment of what thoughts are trustworthy. Because not everything that's in our mind is bullshit, hopefully. I hope some tech person at some point creates the fucking tech to kind of show us on the, you know, screen how many of our thoughts are untrustworthy. How many of them are unpleasant or are fear-based, or, you know, and there's actually a, you know, we don't have the technology yet, but meditation is the technique. Mindfulness meditation is the technique that reveals slowly over the years how to relate wisely to this human condition and to living in this world of confusion and ignorance. And to normalizing it, rather than being angry at it, it's normal. We don't want to take the normalizing and the equanimity and to the point of complacency where we don't care. Compassion teaches us to care and say, what can I do to create a positive change? How can I be part of the solution? How can I be more compassionate and more generous and more loving and more engaged? But also without suffering about it. It's tricky. It's really a tricky balance to find. I feel like a core part of the Buddha's message was don't try to fix the world, try to find freedom from the suffering. But his path to finding freedom, if we look at his life, although I feel like over and over he was saying suffering, the end of suffering, take full responsibility, train your mind, train your heart, practice renunciation, be a good person, be loving, be kind, be generous. And that being loving and kind and generous will have positive effects on the people in our lives and in the cultures that we're in and in the society. It will create a positive change on the planet. I guess where I want to end is the core, I have to keep saying core, is the Buddhist teaching that the refuge that we're seeking is internal, and that there is a reliable internal wisdom. Compassion is the refuge that we seek. Non-clinging is the refuge that we seek. Non-identification with the ignorant parts of our mind is the reliable refuge. And this is something that we can embody in this lifetime more and more with our practice, with our study, with our participation. On this path, it leads to more understanding, more wisdom, more sense of ease and well-being, serenity, and joy in the midst of a world that's on fire with ignorance, in the midst of a world that suffering is common, ordinary, to be expected. I was talking to a friend today. I don't know, they may or may not be here, but they wanted to get a surgery a few months ago, and were suffering a bit about whether or not their insurance was going to pay for the surgery. Really wanted it and was really fighting for it. And then finally got the insurance to pay for the surgery. And then once the insurance paid for the surgery and the surgery date was coming, they started to suffer about, oh shit, now I have to have a surgery. What if I die on the operating table? And they had the surgery last, and you know, kind of was like in a lot of contact of like, fuck, I'm like really worried. Like now I might die. Like, I don't know, why did I want this fucking surgery? And now they got the surgery and came out and was like, whew, survived it. But maybe this was a mistake. And now the mind will just like, I'm suffering about what I want. And now I'm suffering about what I have. And just how brutal the mind is. So often about what we want and what we get, and now we're afraid we're going to lose it, or did I make the wrong decision? The mind is not our refuge. You can't meditate your way to a perfect mind. It's our relationship to the mind. And the greatest example in the Buddha's life was, he said, you know, I've come to this full enlightenment, fully liberated being, but I still have to live with Mara. Mara is the afflictive emotions in Buddhism. It's the personification of craving and aversion and doubt and fear. He said, these still arise. Before enlightenment, I took them personal. I thought that, you know, those mind states were was who I was. When fear came, I was afraid. I wasn't, does this make sense? The difference between relating to what's happening in the mind, relating to it, having a relationship. Oh, fear is present. Oh, loneliness. Oh, you know, desire. Having enough mindfulness to identify what's happening in the mind. Oh, resentment. Oh, the mind wants to resent. Okay, that's interesting. And whether or not we get hooked into it and identified with it is the difference between suffering or not suffering. And, you know, the Buddha said fully enlightened, liberated, but didn't get rid of Mara. Didn't get rid of some of these human conditions. It's not a lobotomy. It's not a, you know, this idea that people are, I'm going to meditate my way into stillness all of the time. Such a delusion. You can't live in stillness. The mind is in motion. It's, you know, emotions are in motion. It's not going to just stop things. Sometimes in deep concentrated states, everything will get real quiet. But that reliable internal refuge is something that is available in each one of us that we uncover with our meditation, with our renunciation, with our relationship to each other. And it's about having space for everything. It's about having a wise relationship to everything, to the lust and the craving and the resenting and everything that happens, met with awareness, a spacious and open awareness, so that we're not pushed around by it, that we're relating to it rather than from it. Anger is present rather than I am angry at you, relating to my anger. Oh, anger. The mind is stirred up. Fear, rather than I am afraid. Fear is present in the mind. It feels like this. It has these physical sensations associated with it. A wise relationship to the emotions rather than absence of difficult emotions. Make sense? All right, you in? All right, me too. A few minutes for questions. Any comments, clarifications, questions about this perspective?
I have a question about meditation. I actually wrote it down. So, all right. When you talk about ignoring the you were saying something about ignoring the reason mind, right? Not to out myself too much, but I found a lot of difficulty with that because in my past, ignoring my mind was a very big tool to keep me in a really dangerous situation. And so I'm wondering, I think that maybe other people might, I'm wondering if you could speak to this. So I get this fear in meditation when I ignore my mind because it feels similar to ignoring my mind in the past when my mind was like, you have to run, you have to find safety, you have to, you know, and it was right. It was 100% right. So maybe I'm mistaking ignoring the mind with my instincts. Or can you speak to that a little bit?
See if I can repeat it for the people at home. Some questions about the instruction around the first foundation of mindfulness of ignoring the mind, bringing up a history of not honoring the mind and ignoring the mind when it was giving good advice and telling her that she was unsafe and that it feels that sort of comes up in meditation of like, shit, ignoring my mind in the past wasn't the right thing to do. And how do I deal with that in this meditation instruction? I don't know all of what to say about that, but my initial sense is knowing that here in meditation, you are safe. And that absolutely you don't want to ignore your mind all of the time, but you want to be able to when it's time to, when the mind's giving you bad advice. So when you're sitting here and your mind is saying, hey, you're unsafe right now, it's not true. Actually, right now you are safe, relatively. You know, of course, anything could happen, you know, but relatively safe. And so it's being able to ignore those untrue, unwholesome, afflictive thoughts. That's an important skill. More and more, I feel like the term is discernment, where we start to identify what thoughts are trustworthy and what thoughts aren't. Now, in the past, if you were not trusting trustworthy thoughts, which were actually saying, hey, this is actually an unsafe situation, it truly is, you're going to be harmed here, I feel like that out of the compassion will help you say, hey, I'm not going to put myself in, I'm going to try to avoid those situations. But you need to be able to choose to be in a situation like this in meditation and say, like, this is not, you know, it's actually okay to sit still. This is a safe space. This is a safe community to be with. Nobody's trying to hurt me here. That wasn't true in the past, and the mind sometimes is continuing to play out those past scenarios. But I don't think that in any way the breaking the addiction to the mind in this part, and especially the negative parts of the mind, is going to put you in danger. And if anything, hopefully it's going to give you more discernment around, oh, that's actually a truly trustworthy thought, and that one is not so trustworthy, that discernment of what's wholesome. And I think the way that the Buddha framed it was abandon the unwholesome thoughts, those negative, discursive, ignorant thoughts, and cherish the wisdom thoughts. And so sometimes wisdom is also a fear. It's actually, I should be afraid now. This is actually an unsafe. But developing the discernment, because sometimes the mind just says, hey, everything's unsafe. Everyone's untrustworthy. And it's not true. A lot of situations are quite relatively safe. And some of the people are relatively trustworthy. I say relatively because, you know, I'm a little skeptical myself.
Which is good. It's good to have a little skepticism.
A healthy skepticism. There was another hand here. Yeah.
Rage, resentment, and revenge in your mind.
Just repeating it for the people at home. Rage, resentment, and what was the third one?
Revenge.
So a couple different ways in meditation. In mindfulness, we would, in the third foundation, right, we start by ignoring the mind and then we include the thoughts. And so you would turn towards the mind and say, like, okay, rage and resentment and revenge. And then you would identify the feeling tone of it and seeing, you know, is this pleasant or unpleasant or neutral? And often in anger and in rage, revenge and resentment, it can feel like, oh, this is kind of pleasant. I feel so powerful to hate and to want revenge, and, you know, it can kind of be fluffing up of the ego self, and it can feel quite powerful. And maybe it's pleasant, but if you really look at the subtlety of anger in the mind, there's a core painfulness. It actually hurts to hate. It hurts to want to cause harm to another being, even if it feels, there's all stories about justification and it's revenge, it's justified, it's, you know, it's, I'm hurting and I want to spill my pain out onto them is almost always what it is you've hurt me. I want to hurt you back. I want to spill my pain. But the Buddha used the example. He said, it's like taking a burning ember from the fire and holding it in your hand to throw at your enemy. You can't do it without burning yourself. You can't hate without causing yourself suffering. So some of the mindfulness will reveal that of like, oh, if I live in this, I'm hurting myself with these resentments. that simple one of resentment is drinking poison and expecting your enemies to die. Holding on to resentment, fueling revenge fantasies, is hurting us. They may or may not give a shit, but it's hurting us. So mindfulness reveals that. And then the compassionate response is, oh, this is painful. Let me turn towards what's underneath the resentment, the rage, and the revenge. It's sadness. It's feelings of betrayal. It's hurt. Let me tend to that with compassion. Let me tend to my pain rather than with anger and revenge, but with tenderness, with mercy. Let me do my own healing around this. Does that make sense? So mindfulness will help us do all of that. And then the other is actually taking on a forgiveness practice and saying that the people that we have resentments towards, bringing them into our heart as an object of forgiveness. I forgive you as much as I can in this moment, even if you don't mean it yet. I forgive you as much as I can in this moment for having caused me harm, replacing the revenge fantasy with a forgiveness intention. And you might have to do that for months or even years before you start to mean it. And remember that forgiveness is a whole big topic. But that forgiveness is not for them. I'm not forgiving you for you. I'm forgiving you because I don't want to suffer. I'm forgiving you for me because I don't want to live with the revenge and the hatred and the resentment. So I forgive you so that I can be free from suffering. We're out of time, or I could go on for an hour about this. Maybe next time. So we're out of time for tonight. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your consideration of these teachings. I don't always remember to say it, but I think it's important to that the spirit of Buddhism is find out for yourself. Don't believe me. Reflect on these teachings. Find your own way with things. Utilize the teachings that feel useful. Set aside the stuff that doesn't make sense yet. And find your own way. It's time, the Buddha would say something like, it's time for you to do as you see fit. And interesting, because he'd kind of show up and he'd give this talk and he'd say, here's the nature of reality and what you have to do if you want to end suffering. And then he'd say, but, you know, up to you. If you want to, time for you to do as you see fit. Do I have any announcements, Sebastian? East Coast tour. Any more for the people online? If you haven't heard, I'll be in Massachusetts on Wednesday. I'm giving a talk in Plymouth, Mass. And then we have a retreat, a 3-day retreat in Rhode Island, Providence Zen Center. And then I'll be in New York City on Tuesday, the 18th, giving a talk in Brooklyn. And those are on the social medias if you want the info for addresses on those. I won't be here next week because I'll be on the East Coast. Jason Murphy, my longtime friend and colleague, will be substituting, teaching the Monday class. Come to class, support the Sangha, be here, not for the teachers, but for the teachings and for each other. So don't ditch just because I'm out of town. Jason's a great teacher. Come support the Sangha. Class is done by donation. Against the Stream's a nonprofit that needs your support. The only reason we're still here is because of the people before you who were generous and made donations. And the only way that we'll continue to be here is if you're generous and make donations. So it's really a radical thing that we're doing in our capitalist society to have a totally donation-based meditation center. We've survived so far. I've been doing this Monday night class for, I think, 18 years every Monday night. And it's because of all the people that give. So you get to be the people now that are giving to the people in the future that will be here. Some of you will still be here. Some of you won't. But be as generous as you can. Consider a $20, $25 donation. And thank you in advance for your generosity. May any goodness that comes from our practice be gathered in our hearts and then shared with each other in this space. And then as a group, both in the room and the virtual Sangha all over the country, offering this merit outward in all directions, shared with all living beings. May each one of us get as free as possible in this lifetime. And together, may we create a positive change on this planet. Thank you, and see you in a couple weeks.
Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.